by Paul Brider. As the train neared Warren, the end of the line, the rice paddies, the simple villages, and the monks from Wat Phapong on Bindabat were a welcome sight. When we got to Wat Phapong and went to pay respects to Ajahn Chah, the first thing he said was, "Waraponyo's come back." So Waraponyo is Paul Brider. I thought he was afraid of sticky rice, kaunio, the glutinous rice which is the staple of the diet in northeast Thailand, indigestible for some people. It was the month for Katina, the ceremony at which lay people offer robe material to the monks at the end of the rain's residence. Wat Phapong is one of the few places left where monks still cut, sew, and dye their own robes, as well as make all their other equipment, some of it quite intricate. Ajahn Chah has always insisted on preserving this tradition. In most places in Thailand, he once remarked, the only people who still know how to make robes are the Chinese tailors in the marketplace. There are many branch monasteries of Wat Phapong, and the monks who travel from one to the other to take part in the ceremonies, visit friends, check out wats they hadn't been to yet. Ajahn Chah got on the circuit too, and Wat Phapong became pretty quiet. I spent a lot of time at my kuti meditating and wondering with trepidation what would become of me. The food got leaner, the weather got colder, and I envisioned a life of walking and sitting meditation, enduring hunger and fatigue, hardly ever talking to anyone. One cold afternoon, as we swept the monastery grounds with the long-handled wooden brooms, I thought how nice it would be, what a simple thing it really was, if we could have a drink of sugary coffee or tea after working like that, to warm the bones and give us a little energy for meditating at night. But alas, it was like an old friend you know you will never see again. Romanticizing a situation always makes it a little easier. But with Ajahn Chah away, even the occasional evening refreshment was not forthcoming. I had heard that Western monks in the forest tend to get infatuated with sweets, and finally the dam burst. One morning on Bindabat, from the moment I walked out of the gate of the Wat to the moment I came back in, about an hour and a half, I thought continually about sugar, candy, sweets, pastry, chocolate. Finally, I sent a letter to a lay supporter in Bangkok to send me some palm sugar cakes, and I waited. I tell this silly story because it in part led up to the moment when Ajahn Chah took me under his wing. It is also representative of the comedy of errors, which was the early part of my monastic career. Katina season ended, and Ajahn Chah returned. The weeks went by. One day I went to town with a layman to get medicine. We stopped by the post office, and my long-awaited package was there. It was huge, and the ants were already at it. When I got back to the Wat, I made the obligatory stop at Ajahn Chah's kuti. He asked about my trip to town, if I'd been able to find the medicine, and finally, what was this box I brought back? It was a little embarrassing, as the ants were a pretty clear indication of some extracurricular activity on my part. The various spectators were examining it and concluded that there must be some kind of sweet in it on account of the ants, but not yet having opened it, I just mumbled that it was from a layman in Bangkok. Then, when I finally escaped to the privacy of my kuti, I opened the box. There were 20 to 25 pounds of palm and cane sugar cakes. I went wild, stuffing them down until my stomach ached. Then I thought I should share them, since word was more or less out and I might get myself pretty sick if I kept them all. So I put some aside and took the rest to Ajahn Chah's kuti. He had the bell rung, all the monks and novices came, and everyone enjoyed a rare treat. That night, I ate more with an American monk visiting from Bangkok, and the next night I couldn't control myself. The sugar cakes were devouring me. My blessings started to seem like a curse. So I took the cakes in a plastic bag and decided to go around to the monks' kutis and give them away. For a start, I fell down the stairs and bruised myself nicely. The wooden stairs can get slippery in cold weather, and I wasn't being very mindful in my guilty, distressed state of mind. The first kuti I went to had a light on inside, but I called and there was no answer. Finally, after calling several times and waiting, the monk timidly asked who it was. I didn't yet understand how strong the fear of ghosts is among Thai people. I offered him some sugar. He asked me why I didn't want to keep it for myself. I tried to explain about my defiled state of mind. He took one. It was hard to get them to take too much, as it is considered to be in very bad taste to display one's desires or anger. I repeated this with others, having little chats along the way. One monk, Kamun, seemed to be a little older and better educated than the other junior monks. I asked him where his home was as a way of initiating a conversation with my limited Thai. "My home is here," he said. "If I go to stay in another wat, then that's my home. It's very simple." I asked about his past. He had been a civil servant, married, was living pretty comfortably, but as time went by, he began to feel that it was all somewhat meaningless, so he decided to ordain. He'd been in robes for 3 years and didn't wish to return to lay life. But the hour grew late, and although I hadn't unloaded all the sugar, I headed back to my kuti. My flashlight batteries were almost dead, so I lit matches to try to keep a view of the path. There are lots of poisonous things creeping and crawling around in the forest. I ran into some black army ants and experienced my first fiery sting, which felt like a thorn being pushed into my foot. The warnings about these little critters were not exaggerations. I got back to my kuti feeling very foolish. In the morning, I took the rest of the cakes and gave them to a senior monk who I felt would have the wisdom and self-discipline to be able to handle them. I went to see Ajahn Chah in the afternoon to confess my sins. I felt like it was all over for me, that there was no hope left. He was talking with one old monk. I made the customary 3 prostrations, sat down, and waited. When he acknowledged me, I blurted out, "I'm impure, my mind is soiled, I'm no good." He looked very concerned. "What is it?" he asked. I told him the story. Naturally, he was amused, and within a few minutes I realized that he had me laughing. I was very lighthearted. The world was no longer about to end. In fact, I had forgotten about my burden. This was one of his most magical gifts. You could feel so burdened and depressed and hopeless, and after being around him for a few minutes, it all vanished and you found yourself laughing. Sometimes you only needed to go and sit down at his kuti, be around him as he spoke to others. Even when he was away, I would get a contact high of peacefulness as soon as I got near his kuti to clean up or sweep leaves. As I type this, I am reminded of the feeling I would get in the city of Varanasi by the banks of the Ganges, sitting there at night when no people were around, feeling the presence of so many centuries of spirituality. Then he started questioning me. I had been there for almost 2 months at that point. It was late November 1971. And perhaps he began to think that I was going to stay for a while. He asked me if I didn't want to disrobe, go back to the world, get married, make money, etc., to all of which I replied in the negative. He seemed interested in why I was there. I told him of my hard time in Bangkok and how I had resolved to come and die in the forest rather than go back there. "Die in the forest," he repeated, laughing. He loved to repeat things people said that he thought were funny and enjoy a laugh. I had studied Thai while in Bangkok and was able to maintain the conversation. He was very good at talking to us on the level of language and Dhamma that we could understand. He said, "In the afternoon, when water hauling is finished, you can come here and clean up." My first reaction was, "He's got a lot of nerve, telling me to come and wait on him." But apart from being one of my duties, it was a foot in the door and a privilege. Through it, I was to start seeing that there was a way of life in the monastery, rich, structured, and harmonious. And at the center of it all is the teacher, who is someone to be relied upon. And finally, he asked, "Why was I so skinny?" Immediately, one of the monks who was there told him that I took a very small ball of rice at mealtime. Did I not like the food? I told him I just couldn't digest much of the sticky rice, so I kept cutting down. I had come to accept it as the way it was, thinking I was so greedy that eating less and less was a virtue. But he was concerned. Did I feel tired? Most of the time I had little strength, I admitted. So he said, "I'm going to put you on a special diet for a while. Just plain rice gruel and fish sauce to start with. You get a lot of it, and your stomach will stretch out. And then we'll go to boiled rice, and finally to sticky rice. I'm a doctor," he added. I found out later that he actually was an accomplished herbalist, as well as having knowledge of the various illnesses monks are prone to. He told me not to push myself too much. If I didn't have the strength, I didn't have to carry water, etc. That was when the magic really began. That was when he was no longer just Ajahn Chah to me. He became Longpo, Venerable Father. At first, I experienced a great sense of relief to be told that I didn't need to struggle so much and that I might possibly recover some physical strength. Then the monks and novices began to display a lot of friendliness and helpfulness. The way that they would converse with me made me feel that they were really interested in my existence. It never seemed to trouble them to do something for me or to show me how to do things. As I came to wait on Ajahn Chah more and more, I spent a lot of time hanging out with the novices, mostly 15 to 16-year-old farm boys, who patiently explained all the fine details of what to do. Their unselfish actions were a strange thing to me. I realized that it probably ran deep in their culture. There was usually a lot of competition for the honor of waiting on him, but I was allowed to go to his kuti for the early morning chores before dawn. It meant getting up earlier in the chilly mornings, but I was inspired. The more I hung around him, the safer I felt. He would give me little discourses from time to time, keep checking to see how I was doing, ask me about my past, etc. I began to feel, here is somebody unshakable, like a mountain. To believe in God is to know that somebody somewhere is not stupid. It really seemed to me that I had found that somebody. He was to me what you always expected your father, family doctor, priest, teacher, Santa Claus, and Superman to be, all rolled into one. He would keep on pulling rabbits out of the hat, teachings, things to do, medicines, whatever, so that the situation began to feel open-ended, like there were unlimited possibilities awaiting me, much different from the dreary path I had imagined for so long. So in the morning I would boil water and bring hot and cold water for him to wash his face. When he came downstairs, I would give him the water and kneel there with a towel while one of the novices took his false teeth to clean them. Usually he would walk around with the towel afterwards and let me follow until he finally gave it to me to hang up. His robes would be made ready to put on for Bindabat, but first he would check things out at his kuti, throw some rice to the wild chickens, sit down and talk, drink tea. Occasionally a couple of nuns would come at this time to discuss something. It was always interesting to watch the local monks and nuns when they came to see him. They spoke to him with the utmost deference, almost as if they were terrified of him. With us Westerners, he was usually the kindly old man, though over the years I was to see him play many different roles. He could make you love him or hate him, feel respect, fear, doubt, or disgust for him, and he could juggle your mind states around quite rapidly. For me at that time, he was instilling faith. Those early morning scenes were especially effective. The wat was almost empty, most of the monks having left earlier for the other Bindabat routes, and we were limited to about 15 minutes before we had to go, so the situation felt intensified. Despite the fact that it was so funny to see the great man sitting there with his teeth out, all of a sudden looking like a little old Ukrainian grandmother. In the afternoons, after sweeping his kuti, emptying his spittoon, and so on, I would sit down for a while to listen as he spoke to whoever was there, sometimes to talk or maybe be given a cup of tea, mostly just to be there. After the guests were gone, he took his bath, with a few of us helping him, holding his towel, taking his robe, offering the dry bathing cloth, washing his back and feet, cleaning his sandals. Once he asked me, "Did you ever bathe your father?" It seemed preposterous to me. I just said no. "Very bad," he said. I had to explain that when we were small, our parents bathed us, but we would never even think of bathing them. These differences in culture, education, etc. were pretty amusing sometimes. Once on Bindabat, an old monk asked me about what I did before coming to Thailand. I told him about my traveling, so he asked, "When you went from America to England, did you take the train?" Occasionally. Ajahn Chah too would ask about Western life and customs, about my past experiences, about science. Astronomy was usually interesting to them. He was disinterested in that he obviously wasn't hankering after anything, yet he was very interested because he all of a sudden had on his hands several of these people from a part of the world he knew hardly anything about, and he cared about us. One thing he never showed any interest in was politics, either domestic or international. Sometime after Nixon was reelected, he one day said, "Nixon ran away with it." A visitor must have told him, and he just passed it on to me with that one line. And then one time when a few of us went to see him, he said, "CIA. Nobody knows who they are." Who is the CIA? Nobody knows. And that was the extent of the political discussions I can remember having with him. In mid-December, monks and novices throughout Thailand may take examinations in various areas of Buddhist studies, and he usually encouraged the younger ones to do this, though he generally did not encourage much study, especially for the Westerners. We'd been studying all kinds of things for so many years, and it hadn't brought us any wisdom or peace of mind, so his advice usually was to store the books away in a box somewhere. He would say, "If you have a bachelor's degree, you have suffering on the level of a bachelor. If you have a master's degree, you suffer on the level of a master. And if you have a doctorate, you suffer on the level of a doctor." And how could we argue with him? Sometimes I would look at him and think, that guy acts like he knows everything. And he probably does. Be that as it may, the time of the exams and the days of study preceding them would be a quiet period in the Wat. There was less traffic around his kuti, so I had more direct contact with him. One night after drinking tea with him and one of the senior monks, I told him over a period of 2 or 3 hours all about my past, the years of unhappiness which seemed so unalterable, the travel, drugs, school, girlfriends, frustration upon frustration, glimpses of light at the end of the tunnel, more frustration, everything that eventually brought me to Thailand. It really mattered little, and I eventually learned that they generally don't take personal histories nearly as seriously as we do. But at that time, it felt so good to be telling them everything. It felt like part of the process of giving my life over to him and taking. It felt like part of the process of giving my life over into his care. The months passed, and I began to feel that I was really living there at Wat Pa Pong and not merely visiting or putting in time. But before long, I was to begin learning how Ajahn Chah trained his disciples. He never really let you get too comfortable. Change was one of the first rules of the way of life. He was always changing the schedule and routine, teaching in different ways, both with the group and with individuals. The schedule might be very relaxed so that you would start thinking, this is the way it is here, this is pretty nice. And then one night he would give a talk and change everything so that there would be long hours of group practice or work. After a while, he might just as suddenly cancel all group practice. There would be long periods where he didn't give any instruction to the monks, and most of us would feel a real need for it. Then all of a sudden, he's giving long talks night after night, keeping us up late, making us sit outside underneath his kuti when it's cold, talking after the meal too, so that I'd begin to dread the sight of him. His treatment of individuals was just as unpredictable. After my first year with him, I started thinking of him as the world's most compassionate sadist. His style was, just when you're getting settled, he pulls the chair out from under your ass. Or, you come in all tired out and ready to take a rest, and he throws cold water over you. I often felt that his methods were drastic and extreme, and maybe he didn't make the absolutely best decision in every particular case, but it didn't really matter, because the practice was to take things as they come. And we could trust that he really cared about us, and that ultimately we were guided by his superior wisdom and that of the monk's discipline itself, which contained nothing harmful. What he was trying to accomplish was of itself pretty drastic, i.e., to deliver people from the clutches of Mara, the evil one, the tempter, which meant struggling against all that was habitual, familiar, and easy, against what most people would probably consider life itself. He constantly reminded us that it was to be expected that we would experience a great deal of friction and discomfort in training our minds. He once said that it was as if we had a friend we had known since childhood. All our lives we had done everything together, and now Buddha comes along and says we have to split up. But during that first winter, I wasn't yet aware of what it was to come. The pace in the Wat was pretty easy, as it often is in winter, and I had a privileged status. I spent a lot of time at his kuti, went to meals at lay people's homes, and took other little trips with him. Then the hot season came. Once again, it became very difficult to get through the days, and I started thinking, next year I will go to stay in the Thai temple in England during the hot season, March, April, May, or some temple in Thailand by the ocean. I was feeling very sorry for myself. The tropical heat was unlike anything that I had ever experienced. Ajahn Chah was gentle, but he used to joke about me, how I sat around with a towel on my head, brooding and daydreaming. One day he simply asked, "Are you the only one who's hot? Do other people not feel hot?" Still, the heat was torment, with the fatigue and discomfort it brought me. One afternoon, somebody brought ice drinks from town. I drank several glasses and felt so relieved that I soon started thinking, I could have my family donate an ice machine to Wapapon. It could be run on the generator a few hours each day, and we would always have ice. It seemed like a pretty valid thought to me. Finally, I began to realize the Buddha lived in the forest and did his ascetic practices without our modern conveniences such as ice, so I could probably endure and survive without it. I later told Ajahn Chah of this episode I had gone through in my mind. It became one of his teaching stories about how to contemplate situations to eliminate unnecessary striving. Quote, Warapanya was living in the forest and the hot season came. He was so hot, he was really unhappy, and all he could think about was ice. But then he contemplated, when the Buddha lived in the forest, did he have ice? No, he didn't. This was wisdom arising. So then he became happy. His problem was resolved. Ajahn Chah also emphasized over and over that we should be prepared to complete 5 years as a minimum. This was the tradition found in the Vinaya, the scriptural rule for monks, but it is rarely adhered to in the present. Basically, what he was telling us was that after 5 years, a monk is able to take care of himself. He is literally said to be beyond dependence. The Buddha, Ajahn Chah said, practiced for 5 years and endured a lot of suffering. In his sixth year, he found peace. But time didn't mean much to me then. I really had no future I could conceive of. He might as well have said 7 years or five lifetimes. It all seemed like such an impossibly long stretch, an inconceivably difficult task. There are many rare experiences that one is privileged to by living in a monastery, and living without a future is one of them. That was perhaps the most terrifying thing about ordaining. I have often thought since then that people can sacrifice anything as long as they still have the future to look forward to. To me, there was simply nothing else I could imagine myself doing, nowhere else to be, no other life to live. Looking back on those days now, it seems like a different lifetime or a memory of a movie I once saw. Ajahn Chah once said to me years later, when you look back, you have to laugh. When you think what it used to be like for Warapanya, you have to laugh. The hopelessness and desperation which I constantly lived with seemed very precious in retrospect, because I was really living in the present moment. My suffering and difficulty were a concrete, tangible experience that I could always get my teeth into. I only attempted to survive. I didn't fantasize about getting enlightened or attaining anything. Later on, friends and relatives would hear about my monastic path and say what a courageous thing that was to do, how it must have taken stamina, faith, ideals, etc. But that wasn't the case. I was simply desperate. Ajahn Chah's way of pushing people past their limits of endurance was so suitable to one like me. Patience is the easiest of the perfections to practice, I often philosophized, because you don't have to do anything. You just have to sit there and bear it. Ordination time approached. The week before, there was an ordination for novices at Wapapong. During the ceremony, I looked over at Ajahn Chah. I thought about the five-year commitment. I felt like a groom looking at his bride-to-be and asking himself if she was the right one for him, if he really wanted to go through with it. Yes, I thought, I do. We were ordained with 19 Thais. Although we were senior to all of them, i.e., had been ordained as novices longer, he ordained us last. This meant that we would always have to sit and walk in line with them. Seniority is a big thing there, and this was one of his favorite techniques, to put you in a position where your pride would get stirred up and wounded. More than merely teaching people, Ajahn Chah trained them, creating a general environment and specific situations where they could learn about themselves and let go of what they'd learned. Over the years, he would say things like, Of what I teach, you understand maybe 15%. Or, he's been a monk 5 years, so he understands 5%. A junior monk said in response to the latter, "So I must have 1% since I've been here 1 year?" But he said, "No. The first 4 years, no percent. Then the fifth year, you have 5%. So I think his emphasis was on training, not teaching to understand, which is not to say he didn't teach profound Dhamma, but often I wouldn't understand something he had taught or said informally, only to have the meaning become clear upon hearing it again or recalling it at some later time, often much later, months, years. And this kind of understanding came, I believe, from the training that had taken place in the interval. I had been told that being a bhikkhu with the vinaya rules to keep would make a big difference, and just having the third robe to wear over my shoulder actually did make things feel different. Ajahn Shah told us that he was our teacher. We were to take dependence with him, and that this meant literally to depend on him for our spiritual and physical needs. We were like children now, he told us, our minds controlled by desire and ignorance. We were unable to take care of ourselves, so we had to have guidance from someone. We were obligated to serve and obey our teacher, and he in turn was responsible for our welfare. This is obviously a radically different approach to living, yet once you're in it, it makes the utmost sense. The same with the vinaya rules. They cover virtually everything you do in the course of the day, and he taught new monks to take them extremely seriously, to the point of not being able to sleep if you thought you might be violating a rule. Many of the rules mean nothing at all outside of the monastery, yet they are a very efficacious tool for training the mind. Over the years, I was to hear him emphasize that the training for practice is moral conduct and correct view. The day-to-day living was mostly unspectacular and often very dull. You might usually feel that you weren't getting anywhere, and then one day, months and years later, he realized that some very big changes had taken place. He was separating us, the three Farang, sending us to branch temples for the rains retreat. Before we went, we decided to talk to him about what we felt was wrong in the Wat, mostly concerning the way others were living and practicing. Of course, this was in very poor taste, especially by Thai standards, but we were pretty sincere about it. We enumerated the complaints, to which he answered, "I don't teach them to do those things," in a very straightforward way. Then he said that it was just the way things are and have always been. When the policeman is around, the thieves behave themselves. If he asks, "Are there any thieves here?" they will say, "Nope, not here." But as soon as he's gone, they're at it again. It was like that in Ajahn Mun's Wat. It was like that in the Buddha's time. So just watch yourself. Don't be concerned with what others do. Then he added, addressing me, "Warapanya is like a football. Do you know what a football is? Someone kicks it, boom, and it flies across the field. Then someone else kicks it and it flies off in another direction. Then it's kicked again." We continued talking and I brought up some other doubts that I had, but now he had taken the offensive. "Warapanya is like a dog with a sore on its head. You know what a sore is? The dog lies down to rest and the flies start eating his sore, so he gets up and runs off to another spot. He settles down, but more flies find him and start eating his sore again. He runs away again, but the flies will always catch up with him because of the sore." It's 7 long pour, but there's a little bit left. Okay. "I was sent to a small, newly established temple in a grubby forest with tiny little trees. There were about 10 monks and novices. Away from friends and the familiar setting of Wat Phapong, I was once again alone with my thoughts. Naturally, doubts began to arise. I was corresponding with a friend at home, and he wrote to reassure me, 'Clad in the yellow robes of a Buddhist monk, you live a life of quiet contemplation, cultivating awareness with each breath.' Sounds good. One afternoon during work period, as I hauled logs around in the hot sun, I recalled these words and savored the humor. 'Rare indeed is the monk who puts an end to doubt. Perhaps nowhere does the deluded mind display all its subtlety as in the dazzling array of doubts, uncertainties, and objections it puts forth. New monks especially are prey to it. As almost anything can trigger doubt, doubt about Buddhism, about monk's life, about the teacher, the monastery, the food one eats, about one's ability or karma, about methods of meditation, Ajahn Chah and Sumedho both had a very direct approach for getting through the maze, which was simply to understand doubt as doubt and nothing more. See it arise and pass away in the mind like anything else, and not be seduced into following it and building on it. When you see clearly that doubt or anything else has arisen in the mind, you have knowledge. So what is there to doubt about? Sumedho sometimes suggested the koan method of doubting the doubt, but more often he emphasized determination to stick to it, let go of your mind, burn your bridges, step off the cliff. During the hot season before my bhikkhu ordination, he came to Wat Pa Pong for a brief visit, and I dumped my doubts and frustrations on him. One visiting Phrong monk in particular had told me that the body is the vehicle for practice. If your living situation weakened your body, then maybe it wasn't right for you, etc. Sumedho said, "War upon you, I've listened to all these Phrong monks and they're all full of shit." But the doubts would always return. With great compassion, Ajahn Chah didn't let people muddle along on the same track forever, but would put them in situations where things would come to a head. So it turned out that he had set me up. As Vasa began, things got quite strict. I felt the noose tightening and I wasn't happy. I was constantly being checked and reprimanded by both the abbot, a crusty old man, and the second monk, a young firebrand who actually did the teaching. There was often plenty of labor, manual labor to do, and the morning and evening practice of meditation and chanting was supplemented by hours of reading and explanation of the Vinaya, which is generally agreed upon as one of the most deadly, boring experiences in the great chilocosm. Unfamiliar with that word. It even cured my hiccup once. Finally, I decided that I shouldn't be living in that wat, and one afternoon I went to the abbot. "I'm leaving," I said. "I'm going back to Wat Pa Pong." "You can't leave," he said. "The Vasa has already begun. You must wait until it ends." "I don't care. I'm leaving." "You can't," he insisted. "Your Ajahn sent you here, so you stay here." "Then I will disrobe," I said, "but I can't live here." We went back and forth like this until finally he said, "It's time to bathe," and got up and walked away, leaving me sitting there thinking about going over the wall. But I stayed. I talked with the second monk, Ajahn Anek, and he acknowledged that the living wasn't easy. However, he said, "It's pure. This kind of life is faultless. There's no wrongdoing which is involved, no harm brought upon oneself or others." When Vasa ended, I had intestinal worms and went right back to Wat Pa Pong. Ajahn Chah received me nicely and arranged rice gruel and a visit to a real doctor. Once I got settled in, I saw that I had grown up some during the past months. Ajahn Chah asked me one day, "You're a little happier now than you were before, aren't you?" He asked me what the Vasa had been like. I told him that it wasn't easy, but that Ajahn Anek was an excellent disciplinarian. He said that the small wats are good practice situations. You're around the same small group of people all the time, eating, working, meditating, and when you get angry or hot under the collar, there's nowhere to go. You can't get away from the people you think are causing you to suffer, and so you have to look at your mind. I generally found that in those living situations, I would tend to fixate on the smallest things, some of them probably non-existent, until it got to the point where the guy sitting next to me was responsible for 70 to 80% of the suffering in the world. It was Katina season and the beginning of winter again. Once more, a relaxed time in the monastery. I had more opportunity to be around Ajahn Chah. I think he was pleased that I survived my first Vasa as a bhikkhu and was pretty sure that I would be around for a while. One afternoon, I went to his kuti to help him clean up, and when I sat down, he asked me if I knew about bunsakula cloth. Traditionally, it refers to pieces of cloth that people have discarded, especially cloth used to wrap a corpse. Though bhikkhus may not take things which are not offered to them, there are certain exceptions, such as visasa, i.e., using something which belongs to a fellow bhikkhu if one is certain that he wouldn't mind, or bunsakula, cloth which one has carefully considered and found to be discarded. In the present, lay people sometimes bring pieces of cloth from a corpse and hang them on the branch of a tree in the monastery to be taken by some monk. Lumpur explained all this to me, then added that, "I wouldn't bother doing this with someone who was going to disrobe, but for someone like Warapanyo, who doesn't think about disrobing, I'm glad to." and told me that someone had brought such a cloth. Would I like to go and take it? He said that I should go and look at the cloth and think, this is a piece of cloth that has been discarded, that nobody wants, and therefore it is suitable for a homeless renunciate like myself. Then I should touch the cloth and consider that formerly it was used to wrap a corpse. Now I will take it to make a robe to wrap my own body, which will likewise be a corpse some day. After all this instruction, I walked out to where the cloth was, feeling like the event was somewhat contrived, and the cloth was clean and new. Yet, when I actually started doing as Lungpo had said, the concepts came very much alive and penetrated my heart. It's another example of the incredible skillfulness of the monastic inventions, which are often hard to appreciate until you actually put them into practice. Ajahn Chah seemed to be especially fond of those who suffered most. In addition to his great compassion, I suspect it was because he could see the tremendous humor in people and their predicaments. Not a callous humor, but a real appreciation of human striving. One such long-suffering Furong was Aranyabo, who I believe is the monk from Mindful Way.
Yes, he's the Ebuian speaker, articulate.
British. One such long-suffering Furong was Aranyabo, a young English novice who arrived in early 1973. He had some good meditation experience as a layman, and he was often positively brilliant in his understanding of Dhamma, but he could get kicked around by extremes of emotion. We had many an inspired conversation as we bathed at the well or drank tea at my kuti. One of his most memorable statements was, "You know, Warapanyo, what we're trying to do is impossible, but we've got to do it." Aranyabo had a lot of restless energy, and Lungpo told me he would sometimes see him walking across the Wat. He's probably going to see Warapanyo, Lungpo would think. Then he'd see him walk back, then across again. One of the things that propelled him and caused him to think of disrobing was the letters he got from his mother, pleading with him to come back home, expressing disappointment in him, disowning him, etc. After a few months of this, he finally told me about it. Lungpo often suggested that we limit our letter writing. Actually, the original Wat Pa Pong rules stated that the abbot should first read all incoming and outgoing mail. But this was not practical for letters in foreign languages, and in Vasa we would refrain from all correspondence. When I told him about Aranyabo's distress and his thoughts of disrobing, Lungpo said, "Letters are sense objects. They move the mind, and this is why he had always tried to control the mail." Still, I remained impressed with Aranyabo, as I was with most of the newcomers, who all seemed to have so much more clarity and devotion than I could remember myself having when I first came. The ones I praised most highly usually turned out to be the most unstable. Ajahn Chah often chided me for my misjudgment, saying, "Before, I would ask Warapanyo, 'How is the new disciple?' And he would say, 'Very good, very good.' And then the new disciple, 'And how is the new disciple?' And he would say, 'Oh, jeez, very good, very good.' And then the disciple would freak out and run away. Now I ask, 'How is the new disciple?' And Warapanyo doesn't want to say anything. Uncertain, uncertain. So Aranyabo decided that he had to disrobe. Since he had only been there a few months, Ajahn Chah let him go pretty easily. He took the train to Bangkok, and a few days later he was back. Couldn't go. But he couldn't resolve his mind. He went to stay at a branch temple and came back to Wat Pa Pong a few weeks later. He told me that every morning he would go to see the abbot to tell him that he wanted to disrobe. And the abbot just said, 'Fine, pack your things and I'll send you to Wat Pa Pong.' Then in the evening he would go to tell him that he was staying, to which the abbot also said, 'Fine.' Finally, he did pack up and came to see Ajahn Chah, but by the time he reached Wat Pa Pong, he had changed his mind again. He returned to endure the Vasa, and then did disrobe after that, and within 2 years he was back again, older and wiser. Ajahn Chah really put him through the ringer this time. He told him he wouldn't ordain him until he was 60 years old. He had him wear white and keep 8 precepts, as is customary, and would say, 'You'll wear white for 10 years, then you can ordain as a novice.' you can be a novice for about 8 years, and then maybe I will ordain you as a monk." Aranyabo sat there quietly as Ajahn Chah would bluster and ridicule him. He waited on him faithfully. One afternoon I visited from Bung Wai Monastery. Aranyabo had just taken Ajahn Chah's spittoon to clean. As soon as he brought it back, Ajahn Chah spat a big red mouthful of betel nut into it, handed it back, and said with a straight face, "Clean it." When Aranyabo came back again, he asked if that had made him angry. Aranyabo replied that it wasn't so bad. In England, he had worked in a nursing home cleaning old people's backsides. Aranyabo became a bhikkhu within a year, but Ajahn Chah kept putting the screws to him. If he asked to go to Bung Wai, where all the other Westerners were, he was refused, even though Ajahn Chah urged everyone else to go there. He was sent to the temple in Ayutthaya for the Vasa. He seemed to have gotten over his restlessness and was willing to go wherever Ajahn Chah sent him. After Vasa, he came back to Wapapong, where he was staying along with a few others. One day I went to Ajahn Chah's kuti, and he was there. He had a sheepish grin on his face as Ajahn Chah was good-naturedly berating him. As I sat down, Ajahn Chah said, "Aranyabo's got dog shit in his pocket." I didn't say anything, waiting for the explanation. "Aranyabo's got dog shit in his pocket. He goes somewhere and sits down, but there's a bad smell. So he thinks, this place is no good. He gets up and goes somewhere else, but he notices the bad smell again, so then he goes somewhere else. He doesn't realize he's carrying the dog shit around with him wherever he goes. There was never any bad feeling when he talked to people like this, because we knew it came from a pure, loving heart. He was offering us, right then and there, a clear and simple solution to our problems, one which he had obviously practiced. His words and his whole being simply said, 'Let go. Now.'"
What became of Aranyabo?
He just wrote again. And what actually went to England to Chipperhurst. When would that have been? He was there. He went fairly early on because he was there for the Buddha Comes to Sussex film. And then he actually ran away, it's a pile of robes and a note in the morning. And then he lived up north for many years. And then I think it's about 6, 7, 8 years ago he made a connection again. And he's been plugging in pretty again. He's been up in the north, so he's been plugging into Harlem. And I haven't had a chance to meet him. He and I used to sort of hang out, have tea together.
Did he ever get sent over to Bung Wai, or did he have to stay up upon his entire career?
I don't think so. I think he must have, I can't remember clearly. He must have gone over and spent some time. But then he did go to England to do with that just now.
And how long was Warapanyu a monk?
He disrobed in his 6th pansa. So he finished his 5th, and it was during his 6th pansa that he left the rooms. And I was over at I was spending the pansa at Wapapong, and he was at Wat Man Chat, remember that one, and he'd come over and ask permission to disrobe. Actually, it was before the pansa, and then Lopa convinced him to spend the pansa and help out at Wat Man Chat. It wasn't working, so he came back over to Wapapong. He walked over one morning. It was about 7 kilometers. Walked over and had to meet him, and he went over and talked with Lopa, and I kind of hung out and to see what would happen. And finally, he after finishing talking with Gopal, he came up from there, so I could wander over. Okay, how did I say? I need a lawyer.
What's amazing is that so many monks spent years in such close proximity to Ajahn Chah. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, on paper, of course, it's not going to guarantee that they're going to stay monks.
Oh,
but it's still a powerful reflection. Like, even with someone like that, it's still, you know, not enough.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. The numbers are you know, pretty, the numbers of people that they spent time training with and left, a lot. In both Western and Thai.
Jeet's husband Ray spent time with Lumbar Cha. And he at first wasn't very impressed with him. When's this guy going to stop talking? I just want to stay in the bottom.
It was, I think, 1975.
What are monks to do when they get things like intestinal worms?
You go to the doctor and take worm medicine.
So that's not considered a breaking of the precept?
You've got to do something. It was fairly. It was fairly calm. Mm-hmm. So you take medicine, clean yourself up.
Or was there a lot of going back and forth between Bapapong and Bowai and Wat Ansha? Like, did the monks kind of go frequently, just in and out of the two watts, or was it more stable, you kind of stayed for a while?
You'd usually stay for many months, a year, maybe. Or sometimes you'd just go over for a visit and spend a couple weeks and then come back, but you'd actually specify that, you'd ask for permission. Like when I went to Wat Nanachan, I went over just to spend a couple of weeks, and I asked for permission to go over and spend a couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, because I was working on a bowl set, and I'd hit an impasse, and I thought, oh, I'll go over, I'll work on it over Wat Nanachan, and then spend a bit of time, come back, and I don't know. But I got sick, so I ended up too sick and I was in hospital for a couple of weeks, so I ended up spending Pansai on my job. That was the first Pansai on my job. It wasn't my original intention. That's what happened.
What was the illness again?
It was something called scrub typhus, which is like typhoid fever, except we didn't know what it was. It doesn't respond to the same medicines as typhoid fever.
Similar symptoms, though.
Very similar symptoms, and extremely high fevers. When I went to the hospital, it was. I've been feeling really bad for a few days, and then they said, oh, we'll get you to the hospital. It was very difficult to go to the hospital in those days. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, I'm feeling a bit better. I'm feeling better today. Maybe it's breaking, And they said, well, we should just go anyway. So I got to, I was feeling better, so I got to the hospital, it was 104. So that kept up for about a week, and then the fever spiked after that. It was like 106, you know, just really delirious for about a week. And that was the pattern. Papakro, when I was the first one to get it. He got it later in the Pansa. Remember him being in hospital and us having to take his mattress and turn it around because he'd soak through the mattress, the hospital bed mattress, and just pouring sweat and fever. And it was Kitty Saro who almost died. I mean, that was the kind of really almost died. We just barely managed to get him to Bangkok, and the doctor said, "Oh, wow, you're really lucky, got her here," and that we. It was actually a nurse who noticed a particular lesion. And then they wanted to do tests on him, and he'd just been, you know, poked with so many needles, he's not going to do any more tests. And but that led to it could be scrub typhus. So then we did a lot of research and figured out. And then the next person who got sick, and we followed the tetracycline, 24 hours it's gone. So it was we started paying attention to the patterns and the symptoms. And
so that means it was some kind of a bacterial infection?
It's from a bite.
Yeah.
it's from some bacterial
infection. Well, tetracycline is a broad spectrum antibiotic, antibiotic, so.
Yeah, but whatever it was from a mite that lives on rats in secondary forests.
It was in a secondary
forest. Parts of the forest were secondary.
As you cut down, you were regrowing.
It actually turned into a. Kind of a research site for, because we had started to document it and we're talking to people, and then it turned into a bit of a research site for other places that being able to treat other places in Thailand. But yeah, in the early days, there were quite a few of us who were pretty sick.
But you didn't take medicine?
Huh?
You didn't take medicine, the tetracycline?
No, didn't know.
You just got through it?
Me?
Yeah.
No. I'm not sure what medicines they gave me, but nothing was effective. It ran its course.
Do you know do people still initially get it there, or is it still on and off?
I've never heard of anybody getting it there. I don't think it exists there anymore.
I vaguely remember when I was there, maybe first time as a layman, so that was about 20 years ago. I remember being told if I get a fever, it's probably scrub typhus.
Okay. Yeah.
But I didn't hear anybody getting it either.
Yeah, one of the things that when somebody gets a fever, then you just check their body, because it's the mite gets on. And it's sort of walking around, and then it gets stuck either in the groin area or behind the knees, in the armpit or on the neck or something like that, somewhere where it's been constricted and it bites. And you don't notice it, but then it turns into a kind of a lesion that's quite distinctive.
So the tropical version of the tick bites that we get here. with Lyme disease.
With the Lyme disease. Except that's a neurological. This is probably not as, I mean, it's a bit more dramatic maybe, but not as long term. If you get through it, you're okay.
Try not to die.
No, I mean, it's not you're dying, okay.